As a reminder, this is a public meeting. Only RAC members may speak and provide input during the meeting. If you are not a RAC member and would like to provide input, there will be opportunities to provide your input outside of the RAC meeting. If you are disruptive or inappropriate, we will ask you to leave. We are recording the audio of this meeting to accurately capture comments and discussion. Please be sure to introduce yourself before speaking so the recording can capture who is speaking. I'm going to state the purpose again of the RAC. The RAC will be used to seek input and suggestions on amending administrative rules prior to giving notice of intent to amend administrative rules with the Secretary of State's office. The RAC will also be used to seek input on the potential fiscal and economic impact of the proposed rulemaking on affected persons, including whether changes will have a significant adverse impact on small business. Additionally, the RAC will consider how the adoption of these rules will affect racial equity in Oregon. The RAC's role is advisory only, and consensus is not necessary. In accordance with OHA policy and HSPR section, the HSPR section will consider the RAC's input for purpose for the for possible integration into the final rules. We will first talk about the proposed rule changes. And then the statement of fiscal impact. I will now open up the space for RAC members to provide their immediate input, and then Eric will do an overview of the OARs. I apologize. This is Gillis Garrett, Oregon Health Authority, he, him. I am the regional emergency coordinator for Health Security Preparedness and Response.
And the first agenda item is for the members to provide any immediate input for the details or.
Yes, whatever you have that you first would like to say or cover the rules. If we don't have anything, then Eric will go through and do an overview of the rules himself, and then we'll open them back up again.
And if we're small, should we do introductions if people wish to, at least the staff?
Go ahead and introduce yourself,
All
Eric,
right,
and
I'll go
then we'll.
first, and then do OHA folks and some other friends that are here if they choose to introduce themselves. Good morning, I'm Eric Gebbie, Director of Emergency Operations in the Oregon Health Authority's Public Health Division in the Health Security Preparedness and Response Program. Danielle, and then the RAC members. Yep, okay. Would anybody else like to introduce themselves? Danielle's having some audio problems. And RAC members, if you want to introduce yourselves, you can, but you don't have to.
Everybody, I was not able to unmute myself. Thank you, Gil. Danielle Brown, Oregon Health Authority Health Security Preparedness and Response Program Planning Chief, and I am the manager who oversees the Servoir Manager State Emergency Coordinator position, which has been vacant but will be filled very soon. Thank you.
And for others, our host might have to authorize them to unmute.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Ah, okay, good. So before to start, I'm a person invested in the program, formerly employed by the Health Security Preparedness Program. Excited to be invited to the RAC. Thanks.
Morning, everybody. This is Peter Mackwell, representing Oregon Disaster Medical Team and also a past member of the HSPR program. Thank you.
Sorry, I nearly interrupted Peter there. Hi, I'm Abby Morris. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm the Regional Medical Reserve Corps Program Specialist representing Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties.
Super. I think that was everybody.
Well,
Nope.
I'm Fran Munkenbeck, and I'm was formerly with the Lane County Medical Reserve Corps, which is now in limbo. But I'm with Servo-R in another, I think they call it Team A. So, okay, thank you.
Sorry about that. Thanks. Gil, shall I proceed with showing my slide and then a walkthrough of the bill and rules?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, let me share first. If I can share. Let me find the right window. There we go. So just as a warm-up, before I show legislation and some very detailed administrative rules, this is the from one of the presentations to the legislature about the Oregon Senate Bill 837, which we're working to implement. These are kind of the four main buckets of work, as a reminder, that was in the bill. So two big buckets of expanding service and then housekeeping. So number one in the expansion of service was expanding membership eligibility to include medical support and administrative volunteers. Since its beginning 15, 20 years ago, the registry has been limited to licensed or certified healthcare providers. But many volunteers gave feedback that, as in regular healthcare, there are many non-licensed folks who are very, very critical to healthcare operations, and it would sure be terrific to have them on these deployments as well. And then number two, enabling volunteer service year-round. Previously, the volunteering has been limited to a declaration of emergency by the governor and a couple other kind of another lower level sort of quasi declaration or finding that took some work and time to get and for more only for serious events. So now with 837, the volunteers can be deployed when OHA chooses to and do that judiciously, of course. And so it's good to do that because our volunteers throughout the pandemic and many other times demonstrated they can deploy safely and provide huge value to the community. And it's just a great value to have volunteers out there more often. So that is not a rare thing we do only when we have a big emergency, but we're practiced and know each other, can operate as a team before the really big events come along. And then for housekeeping, number three clarifies some existing authority to deploy to other states. There was already authority to deploy under EMAC, the Emergency Assistance Compact, that let us send volunteers to other states when they have an emergency. But there was ran into a little hiccup around, I think, the risk management or liability. So we clarified that language so we could do that when needed. And the number four clarify that OHA can conduct health screenings of volunteers to support safe deployments. And on that one, just for background, we do not want to collect or manage large volume of medical records at all and don't plan to do that at registration. But occasionally, as we've learned from certain deployments, it may be extremely hot, it may be rocky ground, and we what have you. And we need to talk to have conversations with the volunteers about is it a good time for them to deploy and can they do it safely? And so just clarifying that we have the authority just to do that and ask when needed that they're able to deploy safely and also not create risk for the state who is on the hook, which is on the hook for workers' comp claims. So let me stop sharing and then bring up the bill. Also, RAC members, feel free to just jump in if you have quick questions or anything, and I'll we'll try to answer or capture it for later or come back to it if we already had planned to cover it. Now let me get the bill itself up. All right, you should see enrolled Senate Bill 837. I will not read the entire thing. It's a practice art of seeing what was added and what's out. So this is not the entire statute. It's the portion of the statute that were changed. So bold is additions, and then the square brackets and italics is deletions. So I won't touch on everything, but a few highlights. Here's where bold and four, where we add that registrants includes the support and administrative personnel, people that help provide healthcare service and public health services. So it keeps us in the lane of healthcare. So it's not registering firefighters for firefighting, but the support and administrative personnel who help enable healthcare operations. And in our context, for disaster healthcare operations, that can also mean the radio logistics people there who are next to the healthcare services, but critical to the operation. And we'll be getting a lot of things we'll talk about today may fall into the rules. But some things will just fall into the program operations plan. And so to capture any of your ideas, we'll talk through whether is that something we want to put in the rules, which are, hard to edit. We don't open them very often, or is that something that belongs to the program side? About do we register radio operators? Well, that would be in the rules, but it's where in the program side where we talk about is it a radio operator that's with, say, the Oregon Disaster Medical Team and clearly part of a healthcare operation. And then here, lot of refining to, in many instances, extract, remove language around things that were limiting it to emergencies, because now part of the statute is for our Civil War volunteers to deploy year round, so it doesn't necessarily require an emergency per se. Here's where it adds the language that lets us, when needed, review physical health, emotional health, immunization status, so people can be deployed safely and also limit the risk to the state. And specifically on the immunizations, I know that can be a sensitive topic. Again, we don't want to be collecting large numbers of health records, and many factors of immunization are a person's choice and don't apply to Civil War deployments at all. So that's not what we would be looking at. But it could be, say, for deploying after a major tsunami, we might have the question raised of should we make sure volunteers are immunized against tetanus? It might be that sort of level, very, very specific, and limited when we can. Let me see. And if you see something on here you want to ask about, let me know. A lot of places where we changed it to individual instead of healthcare provider, because that was a more narrow definition. An individual still means the support admin personnel. Let me get down here. So, to a more interesting part, a lot of cleanup and removing limitations to providers. Let's see here. So, here's where we start to open it up to year-round deployment, not just when there's a governor's declaration. So, for this header, removing that the requirement for the governor to declare an emergency or the sort of quasi-public health emergency declaration as well. So that it just says OHA may deploy volunteers without that limitation. Let's see. Get to another part. And just for your awareness, if you're looking at the actual statute, it's intertwined with many other emergency powers and also deployment of like how the National Guard can provide healthcare services and emergency healthcare center operations. So that's kind of intertwined in here. Let's see. And here, beginning this one is where if they're properly registered, oops, they are agents of the state under those statutes, which means we'll defend them against any claims arising out of their services. That for healthcare providers might be like a malpractice suit is the more common language, but it could be any claim against the volunteer and saying the state can defend them against those claims if it's part of the service. And then just on the rules and operations side, that may be where it wouldn't be in the rules, but maybe in the program operations where we say you are covered when you're on scene. We're not covering you while you're driving there. That's something we frequently put in the language when we're covering volunteers at an exercise, because we don't want to cover them for the whole drive there, but just when they're on scene there. And then new language also just since we took away the requirement for governor's declaration for the paragraph above, just restating for the declaration as well, because some of that's still in play for other features. Let's see. Here's where the statute is about providing workers' compensation coverage. This was a bit of the cleanup, clarifying that we can provide the workers' comp while performing services under EMAC when they go to another state for an emergency there. We already had, there's not new authority necessarily, we had authority to deploy, but we realized later we were missing clarify, just make it real clear that we can provide the workers' comp also while they're on deployment. And let me get to the next big chunk. And actually, that is the and there's a few little bits of cleanup there. Any questions on the statutes broadly or anything at all while I bring up the administrative rules?
No questions for me.
Let me make sure I bring up the right one.
I have one question in
Sure.
terms of coverage for workman's comp or whatever. If you go to, let's say, public health to pick up stuff that you need for a deployment and then you drive to the place, is that covered because you're actually bringing stuff with you and you get in an accident, or is that
Oh.
it's only until you're really on scene?
I
I'm
think that
just
would be,
curious.
yeah, that's a great question. We'd probably talk about look at that specific mission. If the mission is like acting like a courier, then yeah, I think at the program level, we would probably have to talk about that and just talk that through. But I think it'd be a possibility. We just it'd be a limited circumstances if we're really having a volunteer act as a courier like that, and the driving is part of the duties.
Well, that happened during the vaccines for us.
Okay. And so I don't know what happened in that situation. And it also, for volunteers and for us, the redeployment issue a mission order where it should clarify that. And if we need to look back at that, we can. Happy to.
Hey, Eric, this is Peter, and I'm
Yep.
sorry I'm on my phone and don't know where all the buttons are at. But that was a very good point that was just brought up. Part of the non-medical people would be the logistics cadre, and there will be amounts of driving that will occur no matter what for logistics people. So I think that's something we really need to examine and, cover as we go forward.
And that I think not going to the rules, but kind of in the program operations level, like our program planning or something we have to decide by event. And as I read it, I think we would have the option to do that. Historically, for limiting state liability. Kept the coverage too when you're on scene, knowing also that people are volunteering, and also they probably have their own common carrier like car insurance for covering them on the driving. But then if we were really asking for, like you mentioned, for logistical things, that's maybe we need to reconsider it and cover that time as well. But the rules, it's not in the rules here that say the rules do not say we will not cover you on the way. So that's good. That means that the program level and the operation side down the road, we have the flexibility.
Thank
Other
you.
broad questions, or I'll do another walkthrough of a document. Let me see. I tried to zoom in a bit. Tell me if you can't read it. So the rules, which are there to clarify how we'll implement the statutes, these it's got a little more detail than the statutes, but not into the heavy details of the program planning side. And we don't open them up often, so we tried to balance here the changes we made to just implement the statute. And do a little bit of cleanup, but it doesn't get into the full weeds of the entire program. And so one, I'll just talk through here. This is a bit of housekeeping. A few spots you'll see this change because in 2015, this statute was changed to that statute. There's some other cleanup effort, but it didn't get changed in our rules, so you'll see that change in a few spots. This part of the rules reiterate some of the definitions. Some of them are back in the statutes, and a lot of the places the rules are just verbatim copied from the statute to just put it right there in front of us. All right, just a little bit more cleanup here. You'll see a lot of the headers talk about impending public health emergency or public health crisis. We will look at after the meeting, making them consistent, maybe going with crisis, but also because also we some of the things in this now don't require public health emergency declaration, like the ability to deploy volunteers now year round. But it is just a header, it's not the actual rules. So let me keep scrolling till I get to something more interesting. All right, just to show the changes. And yes, we can send this out. All right, so it's got the track changes there. Here in many spots, we make changes to add the administrative support and administrative personnel and removing language about during a declared emergency. So you'll see a lot of those. Definitions. Here, there's some clarifications here because these statutes and rules interweave the Servoar volunteer deployments with the power to create an emergency healthcare center, which is nearly separate from the volunteering. That's ability to declare a healthcare facility as an official, quote, emergency healthcare center under specific statutes, which then invokes some liability and some other coverage for that facility. And they're just kind of intertwined in here. And a couple of things you'll see clarify that yes, a volunteer healthcare worker may be registered with us and deployed by us, and that's under certain rules. And those people may also show up at an emergency healthcare center, but not deployed by us, and that's a different situation. So there's just some overlap and some intertwined language there.
Eric, question
Yeah.
around that.
Yeah.
Emergency healthcare center, and I'm hoping this is just a broad brushstroke because, I'll take it from ODMT's perspective. We go out and set up a patient reception area or a casualty collection point. As far as ODMT is concerned, that's just, doing regular business.
Yeah.
So I assume there's flexibility in that to still retain that without specifically calling it out.
So the rule statute still that if ODMT were deployed under this registry, the individuals would be covered under the former workers' comp and tort claims, and where they are, the actual place that they are set up, whether it's in a building or a tent, in theory could be declared an emergency healthcare facility under this other statute, which might provide some other coverage. But that would be just considered separately. Does that get a
Okay.
question?
So a little bit more discussion. I like the broad strokes, but we can get into the details later.
They're kind of two separate statutory powers. Let's see. Okay, so Healthcare Professional Regulatory Board, the statutes and rules mentioned for the license providers that there's people who are licensed or authorized by a Health Professional Regulatory Board. And it already said that means those boards that are listed in ORS 676160. But as part of the cleanup, also, our own statute already said it also includes people under 401651. So we just clarified that. And those, you can go look at the statutes for those lists, but they're also repeated down below. So I'm getting to changes. I'm not reviewing the entire rule. Clarifying registrant is not just a healthcare provider, but a person in the registry. Pretty basic. And then who that is includes the following down below, that it's licensed folks, but also our newly welcome support and administrative personnel. And that language is from the statutes as well. Let me get to the next piece. This is just the basic part about having a registry and what it's for, moving that it's not just for emergency healthcare per se, it's for healthcare, public health, and supportive services, like the statute now says. Now, what that means operationally can be more year-round work like preventive care. It could be health fairs year-round, whatever it is. And the biggest question from a lot of partners will be, so how much will we be deploying and how often? Once we get these rules done, I think then we'll have a conversations with partners like local and tribal public health authorities who may be interested in getting volunteer deployments, not in disasters but at times, and see what the volume looks like. And how to balance the volume of deployments with what we can do. And we do have experience from the pandemic and multiple deployments going constantly. Some can be a heavy lift, some can be easier lift for our staff as volunteers, regularly do a Saturday clinic all the time, and it becomes doable. Let's see, in this statute, or sorry, this part of the rules. Oh, it's cleaning up the list of the boards. So some boards in the past have changed their names, and so we updated their names to see some changes there. And then
Can I
we,
ask a question? Can you go back? I just didn't understand the wording of within the past 10 years. So someone doesn't have to have a license for like 8 years. Like, could you be a phys can you be in the registry as a physician but not have an active license for 8 years? I don't understand what that wording means.
So that's not from the current bill, but from a bill about 10 years ago. It let us include in the registry previously licensed persons, some retired folks that retired and still wanted to be part of the registry and could definitely support and have supported it. So that statute let us do that, and it limited to people that were licensed within the last 10 years.
And so they would act, let's say it's a physician, they'd act as a physician or as support staff.
So that's It's tricky. They act under whatever the medical board would still allow them to do.
I
So
see.
this let us register them and have them act in whatever capacity is still authorized. So some boards may have no recognition of a previous licensed person or of that individual, and so no, they cannot act as a physician because
Okay.
they just can't. But then other, so it, they're in the registry, and then the boards have powers over what is still within their scope.
I mean, it might be good to clarify that. I mean, because I read that and I don't understand really what you just said is extra, and maybe it should be put in there to clarify.
I'll double check. I think we might have it below, but
That's
let's see.
fine.
Though, yeah, I'm gonna have someone else can take notes on the follow-up items we're gonna get to. That's a good one, and I think it is elsewhere because, as you
Okay.
might have guessed, the licensing boards were very sensitive to that issue, and so this does not let OHA authorize people to say practice nursing. That's still with the nursing board.
I know during the emergency declaration, retired physicians could practice, but it was under the emergency declaration.
That's why we keep this kind of broad, that it's still with the boards, and the boards in any pandemic or what have you make the decision about who could do what. But because if they have none, then the person could still be in as a previous licensed person, just doing some other great work, or now into the new category of support and administrative personnel. Those things start to blur now.
So there's, physician emeritus, where you can still do things without getting paid, and then there's full physician, and then there's no license. So there's three different areas, and so I think it's important. I guess you have to use whatever the Oregon Medical Board allows, and
And
so.
we've I think you always allowed the emeritus one because it is a license from the medical board, so we have to allow it, and we were happy to. Let's see. So renaming up some boards, and down here we added to the list. We didn't add these. These actually were already in those two statutes I mentioned above about that healthcare. What is it? Who are the healthcare license regulatory boards? And those statutes listed them, and so we added them here to just align with those statutes. And the one there may be some conversation about is the veterinary board, but the statute clearly says the veterinary board licensees are included under the category of healthcare providers. So for today, put it in there. Operationally, it might mean something because we don't have a history of deploying veterinarians, but veterinary state volunteer veterinary group does use our database. And so we'll have a conversation with them if that changes this.
During the pandemic, vets were able to give vaccines, as I recall, so.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so that's good to have here then, because if they're able to give vaccines to humans in the situation, then it could be we want to have them registered and deployed under our system. So that's a great reminder, actually. Let's see. Now here's where we get into the parts some folks will care more about of the support and administrative personnel and what it takes for them to register. So they may register if they meet the minimum requirements set by the division. And the bare minimum we want to set here in the rules are being 18 years of age or older and pass the criminal background check that we administer. And the authority to do the background check has already been in the statute for a while. And then support and administrative personnel must submit. I just want to clarify, since we've had years of deploying licensed providers, them getting the healthcare license is a huge screening process, obviously, and they do the background check and that means quite a bit. But now folks coming in without that license is support administrative personnel, so what are our limitations on who can join and what we do? So they must submit to the division in the manner set forth by the division, and the application will be evaluated by the division to determine an appropriate role and function in the registry. And evaluation may include, but not limited to, sorry, some things are popping up here. Let me get that out of there. Oh man. Okay. Professional memberships, relevant training or certifications, licenses, like non-healthcare licenses, worker history and references. And I'll pause on here because it might be as we add the support and administrative personnel piece that needs most discussion. Any feedback from the committee on that? I think it'll be on the program side where, well, actually, say for the Oregon Disaster Medical Team, for the non-licensed folks that are applying to be in the registry and covered, we'll work through the process of saying, oh, you're a member of the Oregon Disaster Medical Team, and we see how you will operate with them. But then as we work through other folks just joining generally, we'll be building out the program processes for exactly, what forms we'll use, and do we have a phone call, an interview, or what have you. Oh, Sophie.
I might add on D their work history, either work and volunteer history or work history paid, unpaid. So encouraging checking volunteer involvement too in other programs.
Okay, that's good. Turn those comments off. And again, I'll ask others on the team to, I'll capture some things, but somebody else, please capture the notes.
I didn't see in the list pharmacist. Was pharmacist in there, or am I just not seeing it?
It's definitely in there. Persons
Oh,
licensed by
okay.
the pharmacy board. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
We definitely want them.
And I know during the pandemic you allowed pharmacy tech, so I don't know. Just mentioning.
Yep, I think they're allowed year round if they have a license or certificate from the State Board of Pharmacy. So they do a lot of great work.
And I guess on that same topic, I haven't even looked, but I don't believe that the Office of Equity and Inclusion was listed, and they license community health workers and traditional health workers. Peer, are
There
they
we
in
go.
there?
Yeah, there's a
Oh,
general
okay,
thing
great.
for all people that OHA, I think, licenses.
So for EMS, OHA, then the community health workers. But we can go check if they have another, if there's any other categories OHA now certifies that would be valuable to add. Can you say that
And
again?
peer support workers all follow under the CHW, but yeah, maybe worth looking.
Okay. Thank you.
I am capturing this, Eric.
Thank you.
One other thing, dental hygienists were allowed to give vaccines. They couldn't draw it up, but is that on the list? I see something about dentures, but that's about.
Yeah, let me review the board here. Board of Oregon Board of Dentistry.
Okay, so it's under there. Okay, that's fine. Thank
Yeah.
you.
Nope, thanks for checking.
Those are good points, Fred. And I'm wondering, I don't know where it would go, but just thinking if it's not already somewhere in all of this language, adding language about when there are like presidential and national orders, like a lot of that fell under PREP, which there were like right, two authorizations. I think there was an Oregon and then the PREP Act where scope was expanded for like veterinarians and oral or dental hygienists to do vaccines. So considering how that could be added under the non-licensed administrative personnel because potentially PrEP or something like that could expand to even non-licensed people or just other licenses that don't have authority
Yeah.
and every other day.
So, I'm trying to think if that needs to go in the rules or. Because the
It
support.
might, it, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Potentially in rules just as a consideration for what rules may need to be referenced when there are emergencies.
Okay.
I don't know.
It may be maybe a space to put in something in rule that essentially says that. Any the rules don't allow for it to be expanded on or to restrict it from, restrict those who are volunteering from having their licenses expanded by other factors.
Yeah, I think for the people that are licensed, like say a veterinarian who can, under an emergency, like someone mentioned, give vaccines to humans, that we don't need to, I don't think we need to mention because it says here that we can register those persons and then their scope and everything is totally under the veterinary board for all of them. For the people who are not licensed, though, under the support administrative personal category, that can include medical assistants and a whole host of people that are regularly a part of healthcare. And interact with patients, but under the purview of the physician or nurse practitioner who's supervising their work. And I think that's still, we can't change that. We're just saying who we can register. And then what the program side, I think, be fully aware of what role a person is in. Are they in a role as a medical assistant? What exactly does that mean? And can they be a medical assistant on any deployment or only when they come with the physician they regularly work with? I think that's something we can sort out on the program side. Let me keep moving along. But so this is supposed to be the bare minimum and then some broad categories of what we look at. And that'll be a rolling conversation of the program side around what we're talking about is people enroll and then with individuals too when they apply. Because it'll take a little more of a conversation than with licensed providers to get to know folks and see how they want to support. Let's see some more basic updates here. Need to department that needs discussions. So it's about the health screenings piece, and this is right out of the statutes. And again, it's statutes gave kind of broad authority to do it, and we just clarified this is our my own edit here that we may require screenings. We do not want to always require them or have to always maintain those medical records by any means. We're not resourced to do it, and we don't need that information, frankly. But when on certain deployments, we've often had conversations with volunteers to make sure they're a good fit for it. And this is clarifying that we can do that And just so folks are aware, we are all about supporting volunteers. So when someone can't deploy to go downfield because of certain conditions, we have more than enough opportunity and need for them on the back end, either back at the at a more desk operation near the field or in the back end in the emergency operations center or working remotely. We've utilized dozens of volunteers in that way and are happy to have that support. So it's not we're not trying to be exclusionary, just keep people safe and limit the risk to the state. And always try and find people a great volunteer opportunity. Let's see. Oh, a piece here also is the post-deployment evaluation. That's just supporting volunteer health after the deployment, checking that they're still okay. Were they exposed to, did they see things? Did they exposed to health issues? And that's part of taking care of volunteers and also for the state risk management as well. We want to follow up people and see if they were getting exposed to risks on scene. And that follows broadly the national standard of ERMS, the Emergency Health Responder Management System, which looks broadly at emergency health responders like volunteers that volunteer after an oil spill. Those have used, they have thousands of volunteers, and they need to have good follow-up to make sure, did they get a rash afterwards from the work there. And so we're just following that kind of standard and making sure we follow up and take care of volunteers. And I think people can still chime in if they need to. This is for the administrative support personnel clarifying when people can be. Sorry, this section is on. The division may close the account of a registrant in the registered division if we learn they're not, this is already in there, not in good standing with their licensing board or criminal history comes into question. And then we add a little bit more because the new language around health screenings and to support administrative personnel. Could remove them from the registry if they don't complete a truly required screening. Like we really need someone to really need to talk to somebody about their health risks, but like going down to an event. And people are more than happy to talk about that and stay safe, of course. But in a certain situation, someone really refused to work with us to keep them in a safe deployment. Perhaps we'd want to remove them from the registry. But in most cases, though, we're gonna keep them in the registry and find the right assignment for them. That's what we do all the time. And then if they fail a criminal history check or don't notify us of something that might have them fail a criminal history check, that might be a reason to remove somebody. And again, that's, yeah.
Oh, Eric, Peter, just a question, and you just hit on it. If they fail to notify you of whatever, a felony, a DUI, or whatever, is there specific language in there that says you must report that? I know within the EMS, state EMS section, that's one of the reportable items
Yeah.
that when it occurs, you need to know.
So we didn't, it's less direct. So this means that they failed to notify the division of a change in their criminal history. That's what that means. And so I see that other language is more, it's a little more direct what the EMS board says,
I
but
think
saying
there
you must.
is a, oh, sorry. I think there is a space that does say that does say you
Okay.
need to notify us. But it's a good call out, Peter. I'm gonna check because I know we also talked about what is how long does someone have to notify us? So I'm gonna make sure what that's in there too.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. And keeping in mind that the volunteering of this program is more intermittent than a, say, a licensed paramedic serving around the clock. So the clock is tighter for them. And also that, just as in employment, criminal history checks, there's a broad range of things that can come up on a person's record. And we do not decide, but it's our the background check unit, which is very, very experienced at that. And they do the vetting, and it's confidential from us to determine if someone's suitable for the activity. And many things are that may be on a record may be irrelevant to it. So again, we're going to be very inclusive and people deploy appropriately. Let's see a little more about criminal history there. Let me keep moving. You might get a little dizzy here.
Hey,
Okay, so this,
Eric,
yeah.
can we just back up a little bit?
Sure.
Prior to deployment, are you still going to do background checks and everything, or are you going to rely on the database as being accurate? And the only reason I bring this up is a lot of the times, if the county's going to need you, these volunteers need to be nimble and be able to respond in a matter of hours, not days.
So for the support and administrative personnel, when they apply, we'll do a background check. It's the same. I've got the authority to do it. I don't think it says we must do it, but at the program level, we do it. Same as we've been doing for the previously licensed folks.
Do you do it every 2 years or just once?
I believe the rule is every 2 years.
Okay, thank you.
I'll double check that for the next speaker. So something
I
to check.
think it's 5 years.
Five. Okay. So we need to look at that and see if it's 2 or 5.
5 years is a lot can happen. I don't know.
Yes. If we have time, I come back and find the exact wording. We'll have to do it by follow-up. Let's see. This section is on the registration of formerly licensed providers and the new support and administrative personnel. It's about their first registration as well as their renewal. Let's see. So here we did have to, so we've got three categories now: licensed, previously licensed, and then support administrative personnel. This part is about the previously licensed folks, about how they register. And then I'm clarifying that, at the 10-year mark, let me say, so when the requirements that enable a formally licensed healthcare provider to provide healthcare services after certain declared emergencies are met, when those are not met, because for the formally licensed folks under the statutes to deploy, that part still does require a declaration. And here we're saying that, just clarifying that when there's not a declaration, but they're registered, then they can act as under the support and administrative personnel section. We didn't want to, due to they still could volunteer and provide great service. Just clarifying that we'd consider them support and administrative personnel. So we can still keep them included, which is great. Let's see. And then number two, a person who is not currently licensed, certified, or otherwise authorized to provide healthcare or who does not wish to apply in that capacity may apply to the division to be registered under the category of support and administrative personnel. So maybe previously licensed, but they don't want to. For whatever reason, you just want to apply as support and administrative personnel, that's okay too. Let's see. And let's just check in some references, updating some numbers. Let's see. Here's a rule, a change in the statute, a bit of housekeeping. It used to say we shall issue an identification card. We want to say we may issue an identification card because, frankly, the numbers of volunteers can grow quickly, faster than we can print cards sometimes. And we may, over the years, go through ups and downs of capacity to print and mail cards a lot. So we try to do it and pretty consistent, but I want it to not be a shall. And the statute changed that and gave us that flexibility. And the card will mention their former provider status, if they had one, what role they're in. Let's see. Here's the part, actually. So we may conduct a criminal background check on registrants every 5 years. That is quite a while. We should need to look at that. Is there any feedback on that? Someone mentioned implied 5 might be too long, but what do you all think?
It is relying on kind of an honor system of the self-reporting. It may be, I don't know, keeping it and then seeing if you're catching people not self-reporting could be a little lax. But then moving it to 2 or 3 years is going to be an administrative wait.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, I'm assuming people who are getting rechecked haven't left the country for whatever time it is to have to get their fingerprints done, but that's when it starts costing more money for the agency also, is getting those fingerprints. So there's a small
Yeah.
fiscal impact.
I will say this. Go ahead.
So Peter here. What I'd recommend is just leaving it 5 years, but putting some verbiage in there that says if there's any change in your status, person shall report within blah 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 days.
Okay, that's good advice there. I think we'll take this, go back to the background check unit, who do the high volume of checks and changes in people's history, and also confer with maybe the EMS program and others, and see if we want to say maybe change it to 2 years or leave it as a in a manner at a frequency determined by the agency. If we want to keep it that broad, or because the statute is really broad, just so we can do background checks.
Yeah, the EMS is easy because they're on a 2-year recertification cycle, so they take care of all that there and then.
I might chat with them and the background check unit to see what kind of what's the common practice of what's not burdensome on the agency or the individual, but also the right frequency to just from history of learning how often things might come up. So, okay, that might be a
I think about, I think that it already is somewhere in here. Sorry, I didn't reread everything. I was just looking at the new language, but I think there is language that if for any reason the agency feels that they should run another background check at any time, they can. It doesn't have to be on that schedule. So that's something that we have. And then also, yeah, anyway, I think we had another statement.
I think physicians get a background check every 2 years because we renew every 2 years and we pay a lot of money. And I have a feeling that I can't imagine them not doing a background check every 2 years. It's hard to imagine that they wouldn't, but.
It's great with the licensing boards. We can rely on their background checks. It's done. But then for the non-licensed folks coming in, we'll be on point for it. So looking at the time, there's been a good discussion on this one. I want to keep moving along and we'll get back to you about, the revision. Again, this is about removing a registrant from the removing a registrant from the registry. And we're talking about that for licensed providers, and this section's about the non-licensed folks. And so this is reiterating the same language. If they don't do a required screening and don't tell us about criminal history. So it mirrors the same as above. And let me look for anything else. Again, a registrant is required to notify the division as soon as practicable, but within 30 days of the following. And you guys read our minds, or somebody read somebody's minds, and we added a change in criminal history. So it's the 30 days. Da, da, da. And here, oh, okay. Here's a related to the previous discussion on what, say, a previously licensed person can do. A registrant may only provide healthcare services. Well, we remove the during an emergency because now we don't need that de declaration. That just broadly that the registrant is
Oh,
competent
no.
and authorized to perform under applicable laws. That means nobody's practicing nursing unless they're authorized to by the nursing board. So just clarifying that this is about registering and deploying folks. It's not about authorizing care or physical activities.
On the physician part, in terms of a criminal history, also, if there's any sanctions by the board, they need to report it. I mean, I don't know if you guys automatically get that, but. I would add, sometimes the board gives some, I can't remember the term, but if there's an issue, it's on your license. And I don't know if that automatically gets sent to you or not, but I would think that the person should be able to tell you that that happened.
So that's elsewhere in the rules around what it means to be in good standing.
Okay.
So that part was heavily debated, but a lot of work went into that years ago with the boards to clarify that. So that's a good point. And in terms of us being notified, that depends on the like our new database has got a lot of data connections right with the boards and notify us faster. It's still on people to always stay within their authorized scope of practice. And that's on them. Let's see. So what is this? This section is about just clearing. So we have a lot of references to emergency healthcare, but we're talking more broadly to the volunteer services because they're not always emergency now. It's year round. And okay, this is one of the cleanups. So for deploying people to other states when they have an emergency there and they make a formal request under the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, and we decide to, yes, we will try to help them. We were already authorized for that in statutes, and then the new statutes clarified that they are officers of the state for the purposes of EMAC because the statutes for EMAC say we can deploy officers of the state, and we're just clarifying that our volunteers, when they do that, are officers of the state for that purposes, but just for that purposes, not for other issues. So clean up there on the rules that was done on the statutes. Again, about identification cards. Let me keep moving along. Sorry, I'm going fast. Let me do some changes. All right, training. What's the cleanup here? It's a section about us requiring training, and that we may require training. Again, though, from an operations side, we offer a lot of training and want folks there, but we're not restricting people if they haven't completed, things like basic disaster life support. They may have required training for like bloodborne pathogen training, and we need them to do that. But many people have that already. And let's see, again, here's some of the housekeeping on coverage. This thing that'll be provided, adding language provided workers' compensation coverage as described in this statute. We had the older language referenced the original statutes from when the registry was first formed, and we could only deploy under a governor's declaration, and that made them a qualified emergency services volunteer in order to get workers' comp. Well, since then, not in 837, but a previous statute already added language saying OHA will provide workers' comp coverage. And so we're just simply saying that, verifying that they'll have workers' comp coverage under that specific statute. And it's reassuring for volunteers and good to have reaffirmed. Again, stating their office of the state for EMAC deployments. And this piece, again, is for the tort claims. So, whoops. Not workers' comp, but for claims against the individual, like malpractice or whatever claims might come up against volunteers while they're deployed, clarifying them that we, for the purpose of any claims arising out of those services, the state will defend them for that. I think that is the end of the rules there. That was a lot. Thank you for your patience and the feedback on that. Anything else? Any thoughts coming to mind, feedback, questions? We're always happy to chat with you in other venues as well. I'm sure as we roll this out in the new year, we'll have more conversations. The statute does become effective January 1st. So I think we're mostly on track now to be ready for that. And we'll have some program processes to work out. And try to take it slow at first when enrolling the new types of volunteers. But we're excited to be getting the volunteers out year round with the full support of other personnel. Gil, as MC for the Rules Advisory Committee, what next?
It looks like we have a hand up, Fran. Did you have anything?
Yeah, I was wondering, did you guys come up with a list of basic trainings that people need to do to be on Civil War if they're logistics? You know, like there's some FEMA courses, whether they still are obtainable to look at, but you know, make a list of basic courses that they need to do. Like you did say, for you know, cleanup of if there's like blood and bloodborne pathogens, but there's also some FEMA courses just to learn the ICS structure. Is there a list that you're going to come up with that people have to do to be on Civil War?
So, go ahead, B. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
The rules have a couple trainings that are required, but otherwise it leaves it open and permissive for us to then make a list of those required trainings after the rules are then closed. So on the operational side, after this, we'll then go through and can, if there are any trainings we want to require or really obligate people to do, we can then do that afterwards.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I
Danielle.
just wanted to note also for Eric and Gil, I think isn't this scheduled till 12:30 technically? So it sounded like Eric was starting to wrap up. And I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Yes, we definitely do have an extra 30 minutes to continue. Go ahead, Eric. Sorry, did you have something?
I've got nothing.
Okay. The other part after going through the rules was if anybody had any comments on that, it's an SNIF form. It's I lost it. What it is essentially. Essentially, it's the fiscal statement of need and fiscal impact. I don't know if people on the rack had reviewed it and had any feedback specifically on that document.
I looked at it, but I didn't have any. I mean, I thought it was pretty thorough and accurate from my knowledge.
Those were the two things we really wanted to go through and get feedback for from the RAC today, was the proposed rule changes and then that statement of fiscal need and impact. I'd love to open it up if anyone has any general comments they'd like to say. If we don't have any comments, then we can close the RAC meeting, but I don't want to rush it along, so.
Just a question. I maybe you've said this. Are there more RAC meetings? Is this the only RAC meeting? Is there anything to expect for scheduled after this?
We were not currently planning on having another RAC meeting. Yeah, if you have more input, you can provide it to us in written form, whether within the rules or just emailing it a text to us. So if you do have additional feedback you'd like to provide to us, please email it to us, message it to us, and we can then integrate that and take that as input from the RAC.
Sounds good.
I'm gonna just pause a moment so it may be quiet as everyone then can wait and think to see if they have any other comments. So embrace the silence.
Yeah, it's Peter here. I think I'm good. Got to compliment you guys on the work that's being done here, and I really like the way a lot of the language is broad, and it is really going to help the state capacity to take care of medical issues and disasters slash emergencies. So thanks to the group. Thank you.
I'll just add in a thanks for being here today. It's a volunteer program and it's a volunteer opportunity just to come to a meeting. We're looking forward to it because the volunteers already have done so much over the years, and now we get to enable even more. So just a big thanks to the volunteers, and thank you all for just volunteering your time to read some rules and join us.
I have one question. How do you, once this is all done, how do you notify logistics type people across the state that this is now an option? Is there, you're going to post something on the OHA website?
It's a good question. And I think that side, the kind of operational side of after the rules are finished, what that looks like is there's still a bit to be figured out.
And so, as of today, the servor coordinator position is vacant as of today because the previous person took a different career in a different spot. And so, we're after a long tenure in that position, and then a new person will be announced and joining in the near future. And so, that person will have a key role in just running that program and figuring out how fast to go on this. How many hundreds or thousands of new volunteers do you want to enroll in one single day? And so, it'll be a good process of just I think working with some folks we know who immediately want to join, like Oregon Disaster Medical Team, we know has a cadre of non-licensed folks. We'll get the word out in newsletters here and there, and then go full speed when we're ready, or when we just have to. I think we might be wrapped up then.
Well, as Eric already said, I really appreciate you all joining us and taking your time to and brain power to look into these rules, these proposed rules, and give us your feedback on them. I personally really appreciate it, and I know Hesper appreciates it as well. So thank you. Hope you enjoy the rest of your day and your weekend.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.